Good morning. This is Update from Amman. I'm Marianne Barasonic, and I'm speaking with Noah Merrill and Najla El-Nashi. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having us.
Najla, we've heard a lot in the U.S. about how the surge worked, and now the situation in Iraq is much more stable. Have you seen that the refugees in Jordan feel that it's safe enough for them to go back?
Yeah, there is no strong improvement in Iraq's situation. We heard, and me myself, I was happy to hear that situation much better in Iraq. But the reality, no electricity, no water, and bombing can happen any moment. And just in one example, one day in 10th of August, I just made a accounting for all how many people killed. 17 killed all over Iraq, 67 injured, two American. This is within one day, and there is no holiday, ceremony or something. It's just normal, usual day I choose, you know. So this is not true. Besides, if the people want to go back to Iraq, they don't have their homes. The government, Iraqi government, doesn't prepare their accommodation to come and have, they can live there in Iraq.
Well, when you say their homes aren't there anymore, I mean, the houses have to still be there.
Yeah, but because of the, unfortunately, this sectarian civil war, Sunni and Shia, so Sunni must leave, Shia must leave, other people come to live in that homes, or the house is bombed. And now we have 2 million, as I told you, 2 million displaced. They live in tents inside Iraq.
Can I clarify a little bit? People may not know that one of the results of the terrible violence in 2006 and 2007 is that many of the neighborhoods, particularly in Baghdad, but also in other parts of Iraq, have now been essentially cleansed of people of mixed religious or ethnic backgrounds. And so in Baghdad, what you have now are many walled neighborhood prisons, essentially, where one armed group controls one block, and the next block over, another armed group is controlling that. This has actually been reinforced by the U.S. policy of the surge, which has been essentially arming and funding new militia groups, in addition to continuing to fund the old militia groups that the U.S. was arming, which has basically resulted in this sort of lockdown that's taken place, which has reduced the number of violent attacks, but has really not improved the long-term prospects for peace at all, and actually made them somewhat more doubtful by deepening the entrenchment of these different groups. But in many cases, in order to solidify their position in these neighborhoods, these militias have given people's homes, after those people were displaced or evicted, they've given those homes to other people, their supporters or other people living in those neighborhoods. And so there's a huge problem with people not being able to go back to the areas they've been forced from. The few tens of thousands of people who have gone back to Iraq are largely living sometimes in different neighborhoods, but almost in many other cases in other governorates or other regions of Iraq, because they're not able to go back. So even when we hear about these returns, there may be people who simply cannot survive outside of Iraq anymore, who go back to an area they think is safer, but they end up being displaced one and two times again inside the country. We hear some of these reports, and we might be tempted to think the situation is better, but it's actually getting even more desperate for the internally displaced people who are inside Iraq. As the media tells us that everything is better in Iraq and that the U.S. will be leaving soon, a lot of interest in the United States can shift. And so I think there's this, one of the concerns that we have is that people continue to focus on the reality, which is that there may be some changing developments in the big picture, but on the ground, things are still very, very difficult, and there still are a lot of ways that Americans can be supportive of people's needs right now.
Iraqi government wants Iraqis to go back without any kind of a preparation for their getting back.
I was in Amman in July working with the DAI team, and one of the things that I noticed was that there has been, in recent months, there's been a 35% increase across the board in the cost of living. Continuing, and this has been happening over the last several years, the cost of living in Jordan has only continued to go up. And while I was there, the cost of milk was revalued weekly. you know, and some basic things like salt, for example. These things are much more expensive now. I think that certainly in terms of pressure on the system, that doesn't seem to have decreased. If there is any other pressure for people to go back to Iraq, it's as we were talking about, that people's savings are exhausted, or in some cases they just simply don't have the ability to hang on outside of their country, or they desperately want to be back to be with family, or to take care of property to see if they can salvage something. So people who are living in Jordan are under enormous pressure. And certainly Jordan and Syria, those governments and their societies are under enormous pressure from the displacement. But I think what Nejla was trying to get at is that the people who are frequently calling for Iraqis to return are people in the current U.S.-supported Iraqi government who see it as embarrassing that so many Iraqis have fled and want to be able to demonstrate significant numbers of returns so that they can look better, the security situation will appear to be a success, you know, to have improved, and that their government will be seen as having more support. I just want to clarify, when I said that a few tens of thousands have returned, I don't want that to seem as if it's a large number. It might seem that way to people, but given that the total amount we're talking about is somewhere between 2 million and 2.2 million people, a return of, say, 40,000 people or something like this, which is one of the numbers the UN High Commissioner for Refugees has given, is a really, really tiny amount, especially when you're talking about a country as big as Iraq with 25 to 27 million people. So the fact that there have been so few returns, given the number of people who've been made refugees, I think is a demonstration that people still don't think it's safe to go back.
Now, going back to the rise in prices, do you have any sense of why prices have increased so sharply? 35% in a couple of months is a lot.
There was actually a really good report that was done on this by the Jordanian Center, I think it was the Center for Strategic Studies at the Jordan University. One of the reasons that the cost of living has increased so much in Jordan and there have been so many changes in the economy in Jordan is that prior to the invasion, Jordan used to receive half of its oil for free from Iraq and half of its oil for half price. And that ended at the time of the U.S. invasion. There's a new deal happening, it looks like now, that will allow Jordan to begin receiving oil at a reduced cost again from Iraq as part of the new, what appears to be a new opening between the Jordanian government and the Iraqi government. But simply the vast increase and drastic increase in the cost of fuel was a huge thing for Jordan. I think also, you know, when you consider that at one point, as many as 1 in 7 people in Jordan may have been Iraqi over the last few years. Jordan is a country with a population of maybe 6 million people, and the United Nations was at one point estimating that between 750,000 and 1 million Iraqis had come to Jordan. They're now saying that number is probably closer to 500,000. Imagine that drastic a shift in population over just a few years, and you can see what that would do to an economy, demands on services, costs of basic commodities. That's just basic economics. To see how that would develop.
And the impact along with the drastic rise in fuel prices,
right.
I could see the Jordanians are probably feeling economically devastated themselves.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It's a huge challenge for Jordanians as well. Another aspect of this that I think people may not know is that the population of Jordan is somewhere between 60 and 70% Palestinian refugees. So people were already living in a very, very precarious situation before all of these hundreds of thousands of Iraqis came to the country, placing additional strain on the resources. The displacement crisis really shows us how the issue of Iraq is a regional issue. It's a concern for everyone. It's not just for Iraqis. It's for people in all of the countries surrounding Iraq. And when the United States still fails to respond in a way, you know, as great as what's needed, it places the whole region at huge risk. Not just the future of Iraq, but also the future of the whole region is at risk because of the continuing failure of the international community to adequately address the conflict in Iraq and the needs of refugees and displaced people.
It's amazing that anything's functioning there at all.
Yeah, it's very, very tenuous, and I think that the help from the international community has done important things, but it's still, as Nejla says, it's very, very temporary, and you never know whether it's going to be sustained from 1 month or 1 year to the next. So it's another demonstration of why the solution has to be a political solution inside Iraq and real attention at the level that's required, And we're talking about, you know, more than the millions that are being spent now. We're talking about the billions that need to be spent on humanitarian aid and reparations to Iraq that could help to lay the foundation for a future of peace and stability.
So, Noah, maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you got involved working with the refugees in Amman and a little more about what your organization does.
Sure. Well, for a number of years, I had been involved, as I think many people who might be listening have, in work opposing the sanctions on Iraq, the devastating humanitarian sanctions in the 13 years, you know, before the invasion, but also in opposing the war and in trying to promote a change in U.S. policy in relation to Iraq, ending the occupation and helping to improve the conditions there. And at the beginning of last year, I began to focus more specifically on the needs of Iraqis who had been made refugees as a result of the chaos and the violence in Iraq. And a part of that process was spending months in the Middle East living with Iraqis and developing a sense of their experiences. And so it was as a part of that work that I met Nejda and others who were working to try to support the needs of their own communities as refugees. And so the one of the results of that has been the development of our project, which we call Direct Aid Iraq, which is a medical relief and peacebuilding project that is a partnership between Iraqis and Americans intended to provide relief and medical care for people suffering from urgent illnesses or violent injuries as a result of the war. So basically what we do is that we raise funds in the United States and then we make the arrangements through this Iraqi-American partnership for medical treatment in Jordan and to help to support people with some of the other issues that come up in relation to medical treatment, some of the social issues, some of the legal issues, et cetera, that occur. So really it's a process of trying to identify the people who fall through the gaps in what other organizations are providing and to walk with them in their process of healing.
Now, when you say the social issues, what kind of social issues are you talking about?
Well, you know, many people have lived through horrific experiences as they've become refugees. And I think people probably can sympathize with the terrible toll that having a person with a critical illness or a terrible injury in their family can have. Imagine that amplified by living in a country that is not your own country, where you have very few rights, or where you've experienced having to live in a war zone prior to that time, never being sure whether you're going to be forced to go back to that country or whether your family is going to be divided as the result of deportation or other situations. So there's an enormous amount of psychological and social trauma that people experience. And so one of the things that we do with our work is to help to support people to help each other, to help to hold not only the particular body of the person who's ill together, but also to hold the family or the community together by helping people to help each other. Nejda, I think, put it in the clearest way that one of the things we're trying to do with our work is to help people to love each other. And I think that's an essential part in such desperate times of the kind of work that Americans can be supporting Iraqis in doing, to help them to hold their communities together so that they can rebuild the future that only they can build for their country.
Najla, you were saying that things have gotten worse in 2008, and you feel like the refugees are going to be forgotten again. In what ways have the conditions gotten worse, and why do you think that they're going to be forgotten?
This year, I'm worried about the children, how many Iraqi children will drop from schools because there is no support for them. This is a part of education. Of course, there is no college for Iraqis to go, so they can finish their primary or secondary school and that's it. And now they are having this hard time again. About medical issues also, last year, for example, there is an organization focused with helping with giving medicines for treat for chronic disease, like diabetes, high blood pressure, and these kind of diseases. And also they support with blood investigations, x-ray, these kind of stuff. And this year they stopped their work. Maybe they didn't got the fund from UNHCR.
There's an issue that has to do with donor fatigue. The Iraq crisis has now been ongoing in this particular form for more than 5 years. And so there's a sense that I think in many ways the international aid community, or at least the donors, can have a kind of attention deficit disorder, in the sense that a new issue appears in the world and the international media is focused on that issue, and so the other issues aren't given as much attention, or there's a sense that, well, that has been dealt with or that's being addressed, so we don't have to give as much support. And the reality is that the Iraqi displacement crisis is only getting worse in terms of the level of desperation of people, particularly large populations in Jordan and in Syria. People who have fled sometimes had some savings, and their savings is being exhausted, and so they're getting more and more desperate. But at the same time, the UN funding response, certainly the donations of other countries, keep being, you know, it's sort of like living paycheck to paycheck in the United States, because you never know whether the next funding request is going to be approved. So it's something that, you know, when we see something in the headlines, as we did last year frequently, the Iraqi displacement crisis in the headlines, there's an urgent push to respond, but then having the patience and the persistence for the international community to keep funding is a huge issue. And then, of course, there's the side of it which has to do with what the organizations are actually doing on the ground. They may have funding for a program, but they might not be focusing their efforts on what's really needed in the community.
It sounds like the long-term picture isn't that good, because if the children aren't going to school, and Najla, you were saying that going to college is almost out of the question for the refugees there, it doesn't sound like the future is going to be at all good for the Iraqis, even after this war is over.
Who pay a lot is the children. Because now in Iraq we have 2 million literate, you know. It's kind of destroyed everything completely, because from the beginning, for example, before Iran-Iraq war, in Iraq education was 100%, everyone can read and write. Then, because of the sanction, which was the worst thing that time, the literate, the number increased. And 2003, we have about 70% literate in Iraq.
But you mean you have a 70% illiteracy rate?
Yes.
Of people not being able to read.
And that went from 100% literacy before the sanctions to 70% illiterate?
Right. Because the sanction, there's two factors that time. Saddam and sanction. So these both for 12 or 14 years destroyed many things where really good was before.
Well, that's got to be among the children, though, because the literate adults who were around before the sanctions have to still be there.
You know what's happened? Because of Iran war, many fathers killed in Iraq. So families, they can't go to school. They have to work instead. And this happened because the war in Iran-Iraq war was for 8 years. Those children went to work instead of going to school. And for after the sanction, now we have, this is the problem after 2003, the security issues. And of course, women and girls, they can't go because of security much more than boys. So literacy rate in Iraq increased and become higher and higher.
It's a huge issue, especially when we consider another issue that's related to that is the extent to which the professional class and the well-educated in Iraq have been forced to flee as a result of the violence.
Right.
There was a report as of, I think, a couple of years ago that said that more than 40% of Iraq's intelligentsia or academics or well-educated people had had to flee. And many of the people who are now living as refugees outside of Iraq are Iraq's lawyers and doctors and engineers and other professionals. And so it's a huge issue, not just because of the collapse of the educational system or the destruction of the educational system in Iraq now, but also thinking about the reality that many of the people who have the gifts and the abilities to rebuild their country are now living as refugees beyond the borders of the country. People like Najla and others who work with DAI and other organizations are examples of exactly those voices and those gifts that are needed for the future of Iraq. So it's another reason why real attention to the displacement crisis is so important. It's true that Iraqis are the hope and the future of Iraq, but people have to be there in order to be able to contribute to that process, either in their communities in exile or certainly to have the opportunity to go home to their country and to participate in that process.
Najla, can you give us an idea of some of the people you've been working with and how Direct Aid Iraq helps the refugees there?
Yeah, we have two major lines for our work, or two criteria, we can say. Number one, we are working with people who injured in the war, and we support them financially to do operations. And the other part from our project, which it is advocacy. We help more than 200 now, more than 200, maybe with the last month after your leaving Nuh, maybe I got about 20 cases as advocacy I worked with. So we can say 220. We have families who they don't know how to apply to UNHCR, or we have cases they need a lawyer, they need a direction, they need a kind of help, they have a problem, social problems, problems with education. So we help them and we put them in the right direction and to improve their situation. Some cases we help them with renting house. We help them to find another place to live in.
A lot of times the services are available and people just don't know how to connect to them.
Yeah.
So you're also looking for donations from Americans. I know when I had spoken to you earlier, it was something that when the Iraqis found out that the aid had come from Americans, it sometimes changed their opinions about what Americans were like.
Yeah, because we say Direct Aid Iraq is investment in peace. We have this kind of bridge. There are many, many people in America against the war, and they feel responsible about what's going on inside Iraq. And this message from those people should be clear for Iraqis, because inside Iraq now, Iraqis believe American destroyed their country and they occupied the country, and there's kind of revenge, hate inside. So we need to make clear understanding for those people that American people are different from government, and we should distinguish between both. And with this money that we help, for example, I have a case, his name is Hussein. He got his injury because of the war and the explosion happened. And the explosion destroyed his skull, his muscles, his toes. He needed many operations. So when I went there and I met his mother, and I told her this money comes from American people saying that we are sorry for all what's happening and what's going on inside Iraq, and we love you, and we wish you, your son, to be better soon. The mother cried, and she said, we know Americans are not evil, but we don't understand what's going on and why, you know? I believe it's kind of washing heart.
Well, I think along with the Iraqis, there's a lot of Americans who really don't understand what's going on.
Marianne, you know why they don't understand what's going on?
Why?
Because of the media, USA media. There is a confusion, a huge confusion in the people.
That's definitely true.
Yeah.
So, Noah, if people wanted to get in touch with Direct Aid Iraq, what's the best way to do that? Do you have a web page?
We do. They can go to www.directaidiraq.org. If you Google Direct Aid Iraq, our pages and a number of the stories and cases about people we're working with will come up. You can also contact us by phone at 802-659-4281. We're definitely looking for people who want to contribute financially to support the work. Often faith communities, mosques, synagogues, churches contribute to support our work, but also groups opposing the war, other community groups have decided together to invest in the work that we're doing. And there also are lots of volunteer tasks that people could engage in. Our work is coordinated in the United States by a network of volunteers, and we're always looking for more people to be a part of that work who are interested in helping this effort to move forward.
Well, can you give me an idea of what somebody working as a volunteer in the U.S. could do?
Sure. Well, one really important thing that people could do is they could help to spread the word about the work that we're doing in their local networks. Because we're a very grassroots organization, what we need to do is get the word out about the way that people can support our work. There are some tools people can use to do that on our website, or just sharing it in the way you normally would with people who you know. We need people to organize fundraising events in their local communities, and we're very happy to provide speakers, including me or Nejla, by video conference. But even beyond that, there are people ready to speak about the work of DAI in the United States, all around the U.S. So if people want to organize an event like that, we would love that. Also, people who have other gifts that they think might be useful to contribute in media production, we'd love to be able to get the word out about those efforts. And also, if people are interested in helping us with work like accounting work, administrative work, we also always have a need of that. So those are just a few of the ways people can help. But I would stress that fundamentally, at the root of this, the work is limited only really by the amount of resources that we have to do it. The work of Nejla and the other Iraqi team members is amazing work, but as you heard Nejla say, often it's very difficult for them to meet the needs of the people they're working with simply because of a lack of resources. And we believe that there's a really important opportunity for Americans to demonstrate that unlike the American administration, unlike the government, we can both make promises to Iraqis and keep them.
Well, it sounds to me like it's a real practical way, if you believe in peace, to actually work for it, because I can see where just helping out, even one person, and then that changes the way that they think about us, that could have a really big impact.
Yeah, I think it certainly does. But can I just say one more thing about that? Because I think one of the things that we're trying to do with this work is not just, you know, the work that you just mentioned in terms of changing the perception among Iraqis of Americans, but I think equally important is changing the American perception of Iraqis. Because I think in the U.S. media and in the sort of the debate around issues related to Iraq in the United States, Iraqis are perceived, and this is a difficult thing to say, but I think it's true, Iraqis are perceived either as nameless victims of war or as terrorists. And I think we have to work to change that perception in the United States, to underscore this truth that Iraqis are the hope and the future of their country, and that they are the heroes of this current situation, that it is through the dedicated work of Iraqis like Nejla and others that Iraqis are being held up and supported at all in this time. So I think if we can bring the voices and the experiences of Iraqis, both the people who are coordinating DAI's work and the people who are benefiting from DAI's work, if we can bring those voices and experiences into the debate on the war in the United States, we could have an influence on changing policy as well as simply improving the lives of individuals. So I don't want people to get the idea that what we're doing doesn't have a political edge. I think it certainly does. I think there are profound implications for us as Americans who are reaching out across these boundaries of violence and ignorance to build these relationships to support a future of peace. Because our government has not done that, I think we have a responsibility to do it. And so it's very much not about charity, and it's very much about reparations and about solidarity with the people who were seeking to support.
Yeah, just one more thing I'd like to add. Peace can bring peace. Love can bring love. This is always, I always mentioned, whenever I have chance to say, we need to work together for a better, peaceful future for everyone in America, in Iraq, whenever we can be. In Jordan now we are. And if we love each other and if we work peacefully, we don't need to think about war and more wars in the future or terrorism.
Okay, I think we're just about out of time here now. I've been speaking with Noah Merrill and Nejla Al-Nashi. Nejla is in Amman, and they both work with Direct Aid Iraq. Now, we'll be checking in again in about another month or so. This is currently August of 2008. Nejla, thank you so much for talking with us, and Noah, thank you.
Thank you, Maria, for having me.
Thanks very much.